This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 26th of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 137 of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Now, this edition is where some weird and wonderful minds are celebrated. People who could bend steel with their critical nous, artists that have made the world stand back in awe and look at the world afresh and then at themselves in the mirror, and creators that are wildly entertaining while talking about it too. Here's what is coming up in the next 53 minutes. I'll meet an icon of British TV and the gold standard for imaginative journalism, Jonathan Meads. He's taken his creative license to bear on himself now, and he'll be up first talking about his new encyclopedic memoir.
It is a collage of both the mundane and occasionally something which is fairly awesome.
Then we skip to Berlin to talk Bowie. That exhibition that busted blocks at London's V&A hits the German capital and the place where Bowie's creativity went into overdrive. So, how does a touring exhibition change?
We recognised, of course, how important the Berlin years were to Bowie. So it was an important space in London. Here it's slightly different. It's slightly more personal and specific to his life, the life he lived whilst he was here.
And we'll chart the history of one of the world's strangest bands. The KLF bestrode the 1990s with their somewhat tongue-in-cheek dance music before burning £1 million, the prophet in a Scottish castle. Where pop and art and politics meet, you'll find a pretty good story.
When they played the Brit Awards, they wanted to dismember a sheep on stage and throw the carcass at the audience, and that didn't work out.
We'll also meet one of Britain's most engaged and engaging contemporary artists, Yinka Shonibare, he of that big ship in a bottle, as his new show hits the UK's south coast. We'll meet Argentina's hottest electro export, La Yegros, and our ears and yours will be graced by the sounds of Denver duo Tennis, this week's fabulous Midori House session. Just try shaking a stick at that edifice of refinement and tell us you want your money back. That's all coming up here on Culture on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound. First things first, and that means it's time for this week's session. Today we hear from Denver-based married girl-boy band Tennis. Seemingly the happiest couple in the Rockies, the band have been carving a sugary sweet pop niche for themselves since meeting in a far less fluffy setting on a philosophy course back in 2010. No heavy thoughts here, though. They stopped by Midori House recently in the middle of a European jaunt to deliver a set of punchily melodic escapism from a deceptively taut backing band so ably referencing the 70s soft rock that Tennis seem to hold dear. That's The Carpenters, Judy Sill, and more. First up, here they are with Mean Streets.
You got pretender to keep the beat. Some say that girl's got something. I heard her name half a million times. Hustling in the mean streets, that's where she learned how to keep the beat. Some say that girl's got something. I heard her name half a million times.
And that was Mean Streets from Tennis. And of course, you know how this show works. More of those later on in the show. And now for something completely diffident. Only joking. Few writers could title their memoir An Encyclopedia of Myself. After all, who'd care about the A to Z of so many people? A gazetteer of someone ordinary. But the extraordinary Jonathan Meads, you would. Meads is not exactly a ubiquitous face from British television, but certainly an unmistakable one. In double-breasted suit and shades, Meads subjectively objectified everything from golf to surrealism via stock car racing, brutalist architecture, and the lure of the slag heaps, herrings and gothic of the North. On a personal note, not one of the magazines that accompanies Saturday's Times were left untorn from. Meads was the restaurant critic of matchless knowledge and ungovernable attitude during my childhood. His memoir, dealing just with the years of his childhood in rural Wiltshire, explains a fascination with place and people from which the writer and broadcaster grew. An Encyclopedia of Myself is out now and is wonderful.
I tried to be entirely reliable. The only invention in the book is the shape of the book, the architecture of the book. The form that I use is encyclopediac, and I have changed some names. It's really an exercise in burrowing into my memory, but every time you remember something, you amend it, you erase something, you add something. It's a classic thing, you know, when four people witness the same road traffic accident, they all have a different story. So it is implicitly about remembering. I haven't done it as a sort of meta-memoir in which I talk in detail about it, but every now and then I refer to the mnemonic process or processes. I have a very capacious memory, but it's also incredibly indiscriminate, a sort of promiscuous memory. So some of the things which I remember with great clarity are things of absolute irrelevance. They don't mean anything whatsoever. On the other hand, there are certain things which are kind of momentous, like man struck by lightning on the top of Snowdon. Because of this indiscriminacy of memory, I did it in such a way that equal value is given to the trivial and the stuff which really should have been ephemeral but isn't ephemeral. And big things are brought down to the same level. So it is a collage of both the mundane and occasionally something which is fairly awesome.
The book has a quality of a child's reminiscence, definitely is obviously written by an adult with an amazing recall. But I suppose it does have that thing where, whether it's something important, whether it's something trivial, it kind of treats both those imposters just the same. Like children do, you don't know what's going to be important and
yes,
what's not.
I did make a film a few years ago called Father to the Man, which was about, my father was a rep for a biscuit company for William Crawford's, and he used to take me to the towns around, kind of 40-mile radius around Salisbury, places like Sherborne, Shaftesbury, Blandford, Winchester, Romsey, etc. And he'd just let, you know, say, see you back here at lunchtime. And I used to wander off and look at the buildings. And It was a kind of unwitting exercise in autodidacticism in a way, but I didn't know that there was a hierarchy of buildings. I didn't know that a church was meant to be more important than a pub, and that a manor house was more important than a warehouse. So there was a sort of levelling out, and there's very little about architecture and not much about topography in this book. That principle permeates the book, I hope.
You mentioned architecture and topography, two things which you're far better known for, obviously, than this memoir at the moment. This is very much about people.
Yes.
And the late 40s and 50s in England were meant to be boring. Their stereotype is that they're grey and dour and boring, and perhaps there were no characters even. This is something that you completely lay this rumour to rest. This is full of technicolour people, ogres and sort of princelings in equal measure, just in the most ordinary people that populate your childhood 1950s Wiltshire.
Ogres and princelings, that's really good. I wasn't adopting some kind of contrarian stance to try and overturn the popular conception of that decade. I'm writing really from a very narrow, slightly blinkered point of view, because the world I knew was Salisbury plus places one went to on holiday and Southampton, where we went every couple of weeks to where all my mother's family lived. But it was a fairly circumscribed world, but within that circumscription, there was a lot which I thought found very rich, very colourful, evidently very memorable, some of it kind of grotesque. And I mean, I was quite a happy child, but one could see massive unhappiness in many adults, not particularly in my parents, but in people of their generation who had lost 6 years to the war and felt cheated by the Attlee, Bevan, Bevin, Cripps government and the terrible austerity and shortages, and you know, rationing went on till 1953 or 1954. I can remember my ration book. I mean, I write about it, remember my ration book. Building was licensed till November 1954. I mean, it was very difficult to get anything built, which is why there is so little in the kind of Festival of Britain style. I mean, it just didn't happen. So a lot of these people were quite embittered, and they were resentful from the kind of so-called generation gap began to kick in. I mean, in my case, it was when I was 10 in 1957, and a friend of my father's turned up and started going on very irately about Tommy Steele, who had been let off national service because he was a popular entertainer. And there wasn't such a thing as child-centered childhood. I mean,
yes, it was still invented by adults, as you say in the book.
Yes, it was invented by adults. But I mean, I can't remember. I remember being taken once to the model village at Boughton and the Water in the Cotswolds. But apart from that, I can't remember doing any kind of kiddie things at all. My parents weren't interested in doing it.
You end the book when you're about 18. You move to London with another cast of very interesting characters in the houses that you inhabit there. Was there a reason that you stopped it there to make sure that it was the reminiscences of a child rather than a young man?
Yes, there's very little about my teens. I mean, there's really just that final chapter, but there's a leap. There's nothing about my early teens. There are various reasons for this. I was sent to boarding school at the age of 13, and so I wasn't so much in contact with these people who I've observed through my childhood. I mean, school holidays was the only time that I'd actually come into contact with this sort of cast of ogres and princelings, some of whom were kind of incredibly grotesque. That was a way of arriving at full stop. It's the age of 17, actually, rather than 18. And were I to write a second book along these lines, it would be in a completely different idiom. I was thinking of writing a sort of brief lives of about 10 or 15 people I know who are dead. I mean, extraordinarily, I made a list of my exact contemporaries who died, and there are 40 of them. I thought we were meant to be living longer than our parents, and I don't think we are. One or two who were briefly quite well known, but for the most part, not. I mean, people who peaked too early, and this, it seems to be a kind of seaside alcoholic death syndrome. Those are people dying in bedsits in Weymouth and in borrowed houses in Torquay and things like that.
That seems like a sort of macabre sequel.
It would be quite macabre, but I mean, the lives that some of these friends of mine lived were far from macabre. They were kind of irresponsible, careless, didn't look after themselves particularly well, but for the most part had quite a good time until the end. I mean, you can't go on behaving like a teenager when you get into your late 30s and 40 and so on. And a lot of them tried it on.
And that was Jonathan Meads talking me around his memoir, An Encyclopedia of Myself, which is out now. You may have heard of David Bowie, the exhibition that rocked the London's V&A last year. After a great run in the British capital, the show is making a stop in Berlin, where the singer lived and recorded in the late 1970s, making three of his best albums, in fact. From the 20th of May to the 10th of August, the exhibition traces the life of Bowie and the cultural narratives of the late 20th century in Berlin's Martin Gropiusbau Museum. So what's different from the British version? And how does an exhibition travel? Monocle correspondent Kimberly Bradley spoke to curators Jeffrey Marsh and Victoria Brokes about the show and Bowie's Berlin years. This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. The Victoria and Albert Museum was set up in the 1850s to promote design, art design and now performance. And I think the key thing about David is he covers all those three territories. Lots and lots of people just see him as a singer, but actually he covers every aspect almost of the creative arts. And even with things that he's kind of dropped off over his career, he's dabbled in the most extraordinary areas. So he obviously isn't just a singer and a lyricist and a musician and a clothes designer. He's worked at making up his ideas about film, video as well. So he's really a sort of kind of multi-talented person. And so for an institution that deals with kind of the creative process, he's absolutely fascinating. He's kind of top of our list. And when we found out that he had this sort of archive, and we sort of knew that he had an archive, but when we saw how big it was, you could just realise you could make an exhibition out of it quite easily. I think the very quantity and quality of it made us think about trying to make a new type of exhibition. And I think fundamental to that was trying to explore the nature of creativity rather than David Bowie. So what I think we were trying to capture in the exhibition was something very different, was what it feels like to be a creative person, how you draw on lots and lots of influences, and how that gives you a kind of resource base to make new material. Hello.
The period that Bowie spent in Berlin was such an important part of his life, and it's questionable even whether there would be an exhibition today on David Bowie if he hadn't spent those years in Berlin. So here it was an opportunity to add to the exhibition in a way that wouldn't have made sense in London, and so a curator has worked here to develop that section of the exhibition and brought in some more personal material, including a letter between Marlene Dietrich and Bowie and footage of the concert that he played here. Of course, that was after he was living here, but in 1987, before the wall fell. So you have a real sense of his life whilst he was here. We had a mass of material, as you can imagine, to show. Bowie's archive is over 75,000 objects, so we could only give a certain amount of space. But we recognised, of course, how important the Berlin years were to Bowie. So it was an important space in London, but it's here it's slightly different. It's slightly more personal and specific to his life, the life he lived whilst he was here. Don't you wonder sometimes? Some vision. One of the key things about touring a show like this is relatively speaking, I know there's huge insurance problems, but when you tour paintings, it's relatively simple. You put them in a crate, you send them to the next city, they're taken out and they're put on a wall. I mean, I know there's more to it than that, but essentially it's a relatively simple process. The problem with an exhibition like this is essentially three dimensions. There's lots and lots of AV in it and sound, and there's a structure to it. And that basically makes it expensive to tour. And that's one reason that relatively few shows like this tour around venues, because they're expensive to make work. When you're talking about kind of doing shows about popular culture, everybody says, well, why aren't there more shows about this sort of territory? But the cost of
creating the sets, making sure that the AV works, means that they're redesigned for each venue. I think the success of, well, hopefully success of this show, it's done very well in its previous venues, hopefully will make a bigger market for this type of show, which I suppose might attract a kind of broader audience than some sort of if I can put it, sort of pure art shows. But it's relatively new territory. And in fact, before the show opened in London, only one venue had booked it, which was in Brazil. After it opened, everybody loved it. And so we were inundated. I don't know how many places have written to us. And now we've got six venues now, and then there's going to be another tour beyond that.
I think the thing about David Bowie is, in his story, the audience have always been so much of the tale. And it wasn't until we opened the doors in London last year that we knew that we had a success on our hands. And it was incredibly exciting because it was really at capacity, the entire run of the show in London. And that is obviously built up now to this major tour. But we'll be interested to see how it does here as well.
I think also in Berlin you're incredibly lucky in having the Martin Gropius Bau, which is a sort of space in the centre of the city when you can take, I mean, it's big enough to take a great variety of shows. And it's strange because obviously in Paris you have the Grand Palais, but I mean that just takes a certain type of show. And amazing things in New York, which you imagine as being, you know, one of the great sort of cultural centres, there is no general space available. There will be from 2018 because they're building this huge temporary space up at the on the Hudson Rail Yards. But there is nowhere for this show to go into New York, Schaffer, where he lives, unless it goes into a museum that wants to take it. And I think Berlin's incredibly lucky. And I mean, I'm just looking at the other shows that you've got on here, to have a space like this in the centre of the city. It's just extraordinary sitting in this building and thinking Bowie was recording around the corner when this building was derelict. And I mean, it's such a fantastic space now. And it's such a variety of spaces with the great central courtyard. And it's great seeing how I think the designers here have done a fantastic job about getting it into the spaces. And some bits of it actually, I think, look better than it did in London. About several bits.
And the Berlin chapter of the Bowie exhibition will run until the 10th of August. You should go if you have the chance. Up next, we profile one of Argentina's most caliente new electro musicians, Lallegros.
Art as a tool to fix our lives? Alain de Botton believes it is. Monocle Films meets the philosopher in the Rijks Museum in Amsterdam, where visitors are introduced to this new therapeutic look at art.
It's not therapy in the sense of, you know, three times a week on a couch. It's therapeutic in the very loose sense of the word. Sometimes in our own life, we're like up against our problems, we feel a bit claustrophobic. So a picture of a wide open view can for a moment just open our minds and open ourselves to better horizons.
Art is therapy. Now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. I don't need to tell you that electronic music is pretty hot in Europe these days, but one foreign artist making her mark is Lallegros, a singer from Argentina. Her tropical cocktail of Latin rhythms, heavy bass and poignant lyrics gather fans wherever she lands on a busy touring schedule. A Buenos Aires native, she recently moved from the Paris of South America to the real thing, seeking to capitalise on a wave of popularity in France. Last week, Monocle's Frederick Bernas caught up with her on a rare visit home.
In the world of music, you always know you're onto a great song when something like this happens. Viene de mí, or It Comes From Me, was the song that launched Mariana Lallegros onto the international scene. Her childhood dream, nurtured in a working-class suburb of Buenos Aires, has become a reality that repeats at every show.
I always dreamed of being a singer. I would lock myself in my room, singing with my mother's hairbrush, closing my eyes, imagining that people knew the words and were singing along with me.
La Yegros and her band come from an electro scene in Buenos Aires that is slowly rising from the underground. Parties in basements and old buildings spring up around town, and the city is a creative nexus for talent from across Latin America.
Obviously, as we all know, electronic music is so hot right now in all different aspects.
That's Ali Silva, Mariana's manager.
Not only does it have the Latin aspect, it has sounds like more traditional music, but over an electronic bass, which is something that you can play at a dance party, play at a club, really translatable to what young people are doing today, you know?
La Yegros, Mariana's stage name, is a reference to humble roots, the time when she was referred to as the Yegros, her family name. Her journey from the Morón neighborhood of Western Buenos Aires to global touring has not been easy. She attended a classical conservatory, performed in theater shows, and studied the music of India and Africa before finding her signature sound, a frenetic mix of Latin styles, including cumbia.
One thing about Latin people is we always keep smiling and moving forward. My music is shaped by struggle and sadness, but also the mix of happiness and melancholy that really identifies Argentina, especially Buenos Aires.
And when Mariana comes back to the city that fashioned her creative identity, she feels closer to the audience.
After traveling to so many countries, playing for people who don't understand the language or interpret the music differently, I love being able to connect in a deeper way. It's a place that inspired me to compose. All the urban noise and the movement is like nature for me.
Yo como persona grande me doy cuenta, ¿viste? Y veo gente jóvenes también.
That's Mariana's mother, Pili Jara. She thinks the secret of the music is a universal quality. It moves people of all ages with catchy beats and positive energy.
La gente grande, los jóvenes bailaban.
La Yegros took off in France after the trend-setting Radio Nova picked up Viene de Mi and opened a window to the rest of Europe. Ali Silva says there is a subtle connection at work.
A lot of the music that we do that's cumbia and chamamé based is accordion based, which actually is sort of a big reference to French traditional music too. So it's a music that's comfortable and familiar to them, that sort of sounds like their traditional music, but sort of has the glamour of being something Latin and exotic and fun. It hits a unique cruce there. Cross. Doesn't sound the same in English.
Morocco is also on their schedule, before a debut tour of the United States and a second album coming out next year.
We're already playing new tunes at the shows. After touring in August, we're going to the States. I've never been there with the band, so it'll be a really important moment to open new doors for us.
Despite this global success, the music will always retain something distinctly Argentine, a sonic reflection of the chaotic urban sprawl that is Buenos Aires. The beating heart of a city with culture running through its veins, tempting you to come closer and explore its mysterious underworld all night long. For Monocle, in Buenos Aires, I'm Frederick Bernis.
And she'll be touring across Europe this summer. Busy schedule indeed. Still to come in part two, we'll meet one of contemporary art's brightest and best, Yinka Shonebari. We'll find out why 90s pop icons, the KLF, burned £1 million in a Scottish castle. We'll get some more slices of the arch-eyebrowed pop from this week's Midori House Sessionistas tennis. Plenty more to enjoy all here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Time for another song now from our Midori House session with Denver's finest tennis. The band singer Elena Moore sat down with Monocle's Tom Hall after playing a few tunes to talk about where they're headed and the influences they're taking with them. But first, let's hear this. This is Cured of Youth.
Who precepts, delicate. Who can resist so easily upstage? Like really, I'm amazed with eyes alight and her hair so bright. Like I'll never find anything so divine. 'Cause who wants shares, baby? I know you can. 'Cause who wants shares? Got them in the palm of your hand.
Very lucky to be joined by Elena from Tennis, who've just played an incredibly pleasant set outside in the performance space. I wanted to ask a little bit about the background of the band. I mean, it began as, if I'm correct, just you and Patrick as a sort of duo.
Yeah.
And is it true that you met on a philosophy course? Is that how it went?
Yes, we met in a philosophy class. I was one of two girls in the entire course. It was analytic philosophy in particular, which is very dull,
right?
But I weirdly like it a lot. But anyway, so he walked in first day of class and like scanned for seats and sat right next to me, and we started passing notes like you would in grade school, and we've been together ever since.
And I wanted to know, I mean, philosophy and pop music, do they sit well together? Is that a common thing for kind of philosophers to be knocking out tunes as well?
I'm still figuring that out. I had a creative writing professor early on in college who said, every good writer is a good philosopher. And I definitely believe that. I'm still trying to figure out if that holds as true for music, which is so, it can be very visceral and it doesn't need to be that contemplative. It can just be like off the cuff, extemporaneous, no reflection, just a beautiful melody. So I think that there's a fine line there, but I would like to figure out a way to be philosophical or at least thoughtful in a pop song.
Is there a lot of debating that goes on in your band about really small decisions about what kind of strings you should be using or something?
God, yes. Over ridiculous things. Not so much like gear, but definitely, I mean, I feel like we had a really insane debate on our 7-hour drive from Glasgow to London yesterday. I can't even remember what it was, but by the time we were done, we're like, why are we even talking about this? But yeah, we're a bunch of nerds.
And what's next for the band?
In my heart, I always want to be Patti Smith and write like just some crazy rock and roll, like pretend that I'm in television or something.
Well, you guys covered television, right?
We did, because I love it, and so does Patrick. Our whole band does. But I think I've been trying to write what is more true to me, like write to my own abilities instead of force myself to play or sing in a style that's not necessarily what I would do.
Right, yeah.
Which is really weird to have your taste not correspond with your abilities. That's kind of a depressing thing. So I've worked really hard to discover, okay, I am not Patti Smith, but who could I be?
I think one of the nice things, though, about music such as Patti Smith's is that it's almost like, and, you know, we were mentioning philosophy earlier, mm-hmm. it's almost anti-intellectual. It's all about feeling.
Oh,
so it's
yeah.
like you can do a Patti Smith song with just two chords. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Which is like, maybe you shouldn't overthink it. Maybe you should just go for it. Go for
Absolutely. You're totally right. And we actually, we have a song that's on the next record that hopefully comes out in the next year, where Patrick wanted to write a song that only had a one note, a single note bass line. And it's going to be the lead track on the record. We really love it. So yeah, there's definitely a lot to be said about simplicity, especially in songwriting.
And Tennis have just finished their worldwide tour, but the EP Small Sound is out now. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Born in the UK but raised in Nigeria, Yinka Shonibari has always used art as a form of commentary on what it feels like to be from here and from there. He describes his trademark African fabric, present in all his works, as a metaphor for the idea of migration and a colonialist mentality he knows all too well. For his latest installation, he's taken over Brighton's old reference library, filling it with names of notable British immigrants who've made a significant contribution to Britain, and we sent Monocle's Isabel Kayser to meet him.
Henry James, writer. T.S. Eliot, writer. Ignatius Sancho, composer. Hans Holbein, artist. And Kazuo Ishiguro, novelist. You don't judge a book by its cover, at least that's what they say. But this is exactly what Yinka Shonibari wants us to do with his new installation, The British Library. By printing the names of notable immigrants on the back of books, he wants to make the onlooker aware of the part foreigners play in Britain's culture and society.
All the books are covered in very colourful textiles. And there's so many of them, there are about 10,000 books. And the scale is just awesome. And it's just quite exciting, but it's colourful, but it's also a very serious installation at the same time.
Here in Brighton's old reference library, the walls are usually lined with empty bookshelves. Walls that tell the tale of almost 100 years of academia and research. But today, those shelves are filled with colourful books, lined with Shonibari's staple fabric, an African-Dutch wax batik he buys at Brixton Market in London.
The wax fabrics are considered African textiles, but the wax fabrics are, for me, a metaphor for a journey, really, of migration, because the fabrics are Indonesian-influenced fabrics produced by the Dutch and also the British in the 19th century and for sales to the West African market. And they're now known as African textiles, but they have that journey that they've made from Indonesia to Holland, to England and also West Africa. So, and I think the story of migration today is almost represented by the journey of the fabrics.
Negro no more. Negro no more.
Though Shonibari has been away from Nigeria for the last 35 years, he says his work very much reflects British issues in a post-Commonwealth world. This installation is a commentary on the Roma debate in Europe, but migration in general informs all of his work.
Immigration is very emotive at the moment. A lot of people get very upset. I mean, I think it's something that a lot of the political parties have to think about at the moment, and also the population in general. And so I think it's a very topical thing to make a work about. And it's really, the work is trying to create a platform or a space for people to, you know, debate the issues. I think that a lot of it might be down to fear and also ignorance as well. Obviously, what you don't know can't scare you. And so it's about trying to understand other people's point of view and, you know, why they came here. And, you know, perhaps a better understanding of people's circumstances might actually help people to understand the debates and understand people a bit better.
This is not the first time that the artist reflects on British colonialism and the ambiguity of post-colonial culture in his installations. Shonibara is known for his theatrical and multi-threaded works. An African-inspired reenactment of Fragonard's iconic Rococo painting, The Swing, headless mannequins in batik dresses shooting at each other in memory of the French Revolution, or The Ship in a Bottle, reminding us of the first-rate Royal Navy ship, the HMS Victory, the sails, of course, sewn in batik again.
Your work picks up on the big issues more broadly on European and African relations, both historically but also currently. In today's world, what are your big themes that you would like to express or discuss?
Well, in today's world, I mean, there are many things that I've made work about. I've also did a series of works about the economic crisis and also works about the greed of the bankers. And a lot of what goes on, I guess, around us, or the things that we're affected by on a daily basis, you know, inequality as well, I make work about that. But I never really take a moral stance, because some of the things I actually criticize in my work, I'm personally guilty of them too, you know, and I realize that.
It may seem a bit simple. After all, these are just book covers bearing famous names. But maybe that is the genius in Shonibara's work, an installation so approachable its message becomes obvious. Britain, Europe even, wouldn't be anything without migrants, the famous and the unknown. For Monocle in Brighton, I'm Isabel Kreser.
And if you're in the UK, you can check out the installation until the end of May at the Old Reference Library in Brighton. Up next, why on earth did the KLF burn that £1 million?
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. The tale of pop techno group the KLF is one of legend. In 1991, they were the biggest selling singles band in the world. In a move as baffling as it was confrontational, they spectacularly pulled the plug on their career by deleting their entire back catalogue and burning £1 million in cash on a remote Scottish island. A gripping new book tries to make sense of their remarkable story in a bigger tale which ties in situationism, chaos theory, Alan Moore and Doctor Who. Monocle's Paul Noble sat down with John Higgs, the author of The KLF, Chaos, Magic, and the Band Who Burned £1 Million, to ask the £1 Million question. Why? KLF is gonna rock you.
Let's start off with the KLF, the band, as we remember them, because it was a while ago now. Some people have distant memories. Just remind us who they were and quite how big they were.
Well, you have to be a certain age to know of them, because they sort of managed to erase themselves from music history. This is why you never hear their music in film soundtracks or on games or on Ministry of Sound compilations. If you're about 35 or younger, you've never heard of them. So to discover that there was this band who were the best-selling singles band in the entire world, who won the Brits, who just this, well, a couple of months ago were named the second best band of all times by the Times of all people, after the Beatles. It's shocking to people that a band like that can disappear from our culture so easily.
And in the title of your book, you sort of very clearly point to the fact which most people now remember them for, which is that they burned £1 million.
Yeah, after they split up, they deleted their entire catalogue, which probably cost them far more than £1 million over the years. They burnt the master tapes and they took their remaining money, which was £1 million, and they flew it up to Jura in the Scottish Hebrides, and they went in the middle of the night to a deserted boathouse and they set fire to the lot, and they couldn't say why. They were unable to give an explanation for their answers, and that is the starting point for the book, I think. Hundreds of journalists have spoken to Bill Drummond and Jimmy Courtney, who are the two members of the KLF, and tried to make some sense of it. And they've got absolutely nowhere. And you have to face the fact that I don't think Bill or Jimmy knew exactly what was going on either. The only way to deal with it was to sort of step back as far as possible and just to find a framework that you could sort of understand their actions in. So, yeah, it's not a typical music biography by a very long chalk.
With the burning of the money, when you say they didn't understand it at the time, what do you think their impetus was? Do you think they did it as an act of defiance or as sort of as a piece of art, or were they trying to sort of summon a reaction? Looking back on it now, what does that mean, burning £1 million?
Well, I mean, it was interesting. After they'd done it a year later and they were still trying to come to terms with it, their roadie, a guy called Gimpo, had filmed the thing. So they went around and showed the film of the money burning to try and get an answer to that question, why did we do it? And people wondered whether it was art, whether it's a political statement, whether it was a scam, whether it was some promotional tool. And it was clearly none of those things. None of those things really made sense. What it was a compulsion. They just felt compelled to do it. And that compulsion was so strong that they went through with it. And it's one thing to start burning £1 million, but it's quite another thing to finish burning £1 million. And so it's the book is really trying to understand what that compulsion was and where it's coming about.
So why, Bill? Why?
There was a lot of reasons why, and there's still a lot. We're still discovering reasons every day.
The people in our audience are not really tuned in. They think I'm kidding. They think I'm joking. They think that it's funny money or Monopoly or whatever.
That's serious.
It's actual money. Yeah. And is there a philosophy behind this? Is this sort of a denial of the material world or something?
No. Some days it is that, but it's not really that. You know, we could have done with the money. We wanted the money, but we wanted to burn it more.
Negating the power of money is very much part of it. If you look at the history of Bill and Jimmy's working relationship, they originally formed a band called the Justified Ancients of Moomoo, which is a name of a Discordian anarchist terrorist cell, if you like, from a book called The Illuminatus and by Robert Anton Wilson and Robert Shea. The aim of the Justified Ancients of Moomoo was to be the spirit of chaos in the music industry. They're coming from that angle. That was their starting point. They wanted to embody the Justified Ancients of Moomoo. So from that point on, it's not going to be a normal music story by a long distance.
And do you think they ever saw themselves as musicians or artists? Or do you think for them it was more of a prank and a statement?
I don't think they'd ever see themselves as pranksters. I think everything they did was totally sincere and was their best attempt at expressing what was in themselves. They hate the word prank, they hate the word scam. Often they would try and do something and it wouldn't quite work out. For instance, when they played the Brit Awards, they wanted to dismember a sheep on stage and throw the carcass at the audience, and that didn't work out. And so they sort of left a dead sheep on the steps so that all the great and the good of the music industry had to wade through the blood to sort of get out. And people say it was a scam or something like that. And it was just sort of a thing that failed, but it certainly wasn't a prank, put it that way.
And how's the reaction to the book been? Because it's been out for a few months now and
it's I can't quite believe my luck, to be honest. I wrote it thinking that nobody at all cared about the KLF or Robert Anton Wilson. They were just not in the public conversation at all. And I released it just independently on Kindle initially, just to sort of gauge what people's reaction was, because I was aware it was a very strange book. And much to my surprise, there was a huge amount of people who were sort of desperate to sort of come to terms with what happened as well. Because you remember, it was on such a public stage. You know, this weird da-da sort of occult thing was happening on top of the Pops when they were number one. It was, you know, it was, they were in the Sun. It was front and centre in our culture. And people have just been stunned for 20 years trying to come to terms with what happened to it.
That was Paul Noble talking to John Higgs, whose book on the KLF is published by Phoenix. And that's all we have time for on today's show. Next week, it's all about comic books, so get ready to geek it up. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Daphne Denis. And in preparation for next week's show, Holly Fisher has already put her pants on outside her tights and tied a neat cape on. Watch this space. Now time for one last song this week from their Midori House session. Here are Tennis with 100 Lovers. Thanks, as ever, for tuning in.
Thank you.